First they think you're crazy, then they fight you, and then all of a sudden you change the world.
Health and biotech news, a tech bro or sis would find kind of interesting.
We are here to celebrate the completion of the first survey.
On the advice of counsel, I will not be giving an opening statement.
Of the entire human genome.
All right, guys, let's do this story on VCs' dirty money and questioning where are VCs raising their money from and whether we should care. And then we'll finish off by doing the $1 trillion opportunity in Alzheimer's disease. So Imran, do you want to start off with this VC dirty money story? This was on Sifted by Tessa Clark.
So the crux of the story is that the poor class of venture capital investors are having a pretty rough time out there. They're having to go further afield than they might otherwise to raise their money from their LPs, their limited partners, that they then invest in the companies that they pick for investment, like the early stage startups. And this article basically makes the case that a lot of VC funds are basically raising money from institutional investors or sovereign wealth funds, or sometimes even potentially ultra high net worth individuals, in countries or in societies where some of the human rights records would be like questionable or would challenge the kind of values that, you know, are presumably, this is written by a British founder turned investor, that, you know, founders in the UK would basically struggle to, you know, to come to terms with. But because that money is basically wrapped up in the kind of fancy packaging of a tier one, tier two VC fund, and then comes with that label of like authority and credibility, by the time it hits the founders and the company's bank accounts, people are like not looking beyond where the money's come from, and they're just kind of taking it, running with it, and building their companies. And basically what she's saying is that, you know, this has to change. Like, if you want to be taken seriously, and if you want to also protect your interests as a business, as a founder, and you also want to do the right thing, you need to understand where the hell your money comes from. Now, classically, when someone says there's like diligence happening in early stage investing or VC investing, it's always the fund diligencing the startup. For example, asking for data, asking to prove their product metrics, showing, giving them access to like bank account statements, whatever it may be, to verify that the company is legit, they have customers, they're doing whatever it is that they say they're doing. This could be scientific due diligence. Tessa Clark here is saying that startups should do diligence on their investors for the reasons that I just mentioned. That's the story. Would love to hear what you have to say. Adam, I know you raised capital for your company. I have as well. I have some specific thoughts on this, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, my take is, I think it's not really the job of a founder to be looking at the source of LP money. The job of the founder is to grow the company and get necessary funding.
Podcast.
It's really difficult. No, it's really difficult to say no to money that is on the table. It's really difficult to say no to money that is on the table. So I feel like this is just a kind of a novelty that a very small amount of startups can have when you can pick and choose different sources of money. Jason Calacanis, a big angel investor, actually asked his audience of founders, how many of you care about the source of money? And I think it was only about 25% of people said they care. And I think when it comes down to it, even those people, most of them will take the money without question.
So Tessa's presenting data here. Maybe there's a difference between US and UK founders. But she basically said that like 75% of polled founders actually think it's really important that they have more information on the funding sources of investors. So there could be like, depending on when Jason's data was collected, there could be like a changing in the tide, or it could be like a geographical variation in founders across the pond. But I think
I think poll data isn't interesting. It's more, this is more of a revealed preference problem.
Yeah, stated preferences versus revealed preferences.
And I think your point about it being like a kind of luxury belief is spot on, because the truth is that most founders will not have like a very high level of competition to invest in their company. Some of them will, the best ones will. And oftentimes the best ones are like experienced founders, or they've been through the cycle as an early employer, they've seen it before. So first time round, it's like very, very hard to be in a position to do that.
Can you flesh out this a bit as two people who've raised money? How likely is it that as a founder, just if you go through the process of raising money, and how likely is it that you would be in a position where you have the options to go, okay, tell me who your LPs are they ethical, and I'm going to pick and choose? Is that like a likely outcome as someone building in health?
I mean, you can't do that, and most funds will probably be willing to share some data on that. It's not as if like the relationship is totally one-sided. You can ask, I mean, many people choose their VCs and funders based on different metrics. Their source of money wouldn't be one of them, I think, but it would be things like, you know, how helpful they are, their network, where they're located.
Yeah, the best way to solve this problem, I think, would be to have, like, you know how you have, like, B Corp certification, or you have some kind of accepted standard in the industry? So as Adam says, like, this shouldn't be the founder's problem. Like, you've got 99 problems, and, like, due diligencing your VC funds LPs should not be one of them. Like, there should be some way or some best practice or code of conduct in the industry where people are just adhering to a commonly recognized basic standard of sourcing, ethical sourcing, what have you, of LP money. And that should be something that, you know, that's actually a startup opportunity, by the way, I think, for, like, somebody who wants to do this and rinse VCs for some new money, which would give some people a great deal of pleasure, is, yeah, basically to create that standard and then to basically sell that accreditation to funds that are raising money and just to give that confidence. But I can tell you my own personal experience is that the way that fundraising works is, like, very peculiar to people that don't understand it. And as an early stage startup, you have very strange dynamics in the fundraising process. Any startup founder that goes to market early, like from the beginning of fundraising, and starts having conversations with people, and then in, like, interviews and pitches, starts grilling the VC on their source of funding, I actually think that that's going to, like, kill your chances, like, dead in the water. The way that this thing usually works is that, okay, sometimes you'll have, like, investors that commit, but that can happen very, very late in the fundraising process. So you have to kiss a lot of frogs before you found, like, investor company or investor founder fit. You find an investor, and in an ideal situation, you want to have, like, more than one investor, at least two or more, basically bidding for the company, not because you want to get the highest price, but you want to be in a situation where you control. You're like a price setter. You're controlling the terms. You're setting the pace. You're creating a bit of competition there that just keeps the momentum in the deal and makes people fight to get it closed. If you're not in that situation, then you're basically at the mercy of the person that's investing and their timeline, their process, and everything, because they have no incentive to go any quicker. So that's why I think it can be very difficult and very fragile to bring these things up early. And most founders, I think, simply won't do it. In my own experience, I actually have done financial and, like, reputational due diligence on investors in the past.
Of course you have.
Yeah, no, seriously. No, I have. I've actually paid money to people that specialize in this. And, like,
Adam, you say it like it's a bad thing.
No, because I think, yeah, and I know for a fact that there are, like, service providers that will sell those types of services, like, you know your customer type services and what have you, right? It is an accessible thing. You can do it. And I also know recently, like, you know, as the kind of political sands have shifted, even in the last 18 months or so, there will be certain, like, funds, certain angel investors, certain communities that previously were, like, very welcome to invest in UK founders, but that line has moved. So there'll be companies that are, like, holding investments from entities that are now no longer, like, you know, welcome to invest in British businesses or perceived in the same way. There are even venture capital funds that have disbanded and basically shut down because their LP base, you know, it was in certain countries, certain communities that are now, like, not welcome to invest or may even have sanctions against them.
Wait, Adam, can you, and then Imran follow up, can you flesh out, I'm really interested in this power dynamic of you as a health founder and as an investor. Can you maybe flesh out maybe how it varies as well between different businesses? Like, who's in charge? Who's setting the rules? Who is the one who can be making demands saying, you know, you're not ethical, you're not this, you're not that? And does it vary across different businesses? Adam, do you want to start?
It's not about being in charge. It's more about, as Imran said, it's a numbers game. When you talk to, you know, a big number of VCs and investors, some people will indicate interest. Then you'll start a due diligence process where you have a few more meetings. In my experience, UK investors do way more diligence, and the process with UK investors is much longer than US investors. And then they make some kind of offer that is based on your kind of initial offering. I don't see it as a power dynamic, but I think it just shows lack of focus if you're asking about sources of funding. It sends out a red flag to VCs.
Investors want, like, missionaries. They want missionaries. They want people who are, like, you know, not, like, optimizing, like, 100 different things you know, at the same time, including work-life, I'm sorry to say it, but like some investors will look at it that way. They want somebody who's just like insanely focused on solving a specific problem. Adam's right. Like, although it might be the right thing to do, and I'm not disagreeing with like Tesla's push here, if you're out there and you're like saying, yeah, I'm absolutely critically focused on solving this problem. Oh, by the way, like, can you give me a list of all your LPs and can we talk about like where their money comes from? And so, like, they're just gonna be like, what's going on here? Like, this is just really cutting against the grain of their expectations. Again, not saying it's not the right thing to do, but it's going to have an impact on your fundraising.
Is it a bit hypocritical to be saying, I'm going to change the world, my mission is to improve a billion lives, you know, all of this stuff, and then be taking money from regimes or countries who are doing awful things? Isn't that just a huge own goal in terms of what you say you're going to do and what you're actually doing?
I mean, not necessarily, because that money that you're taking is part of these countries' like efforts to diversify and move into kind of more liberal countries. So, I mean, you can look at it that way.
No, I mean, I would disagree. I think it is, there's an inherent contradiction there. And my position on this, I'm not saying it's not the founder's responsibility to have done some basic level of research, but I don't think it's feasible or practical for the founder community at large to be the one that are bearing the burden for all of this. But I do think it is a bit hypocritical. It depends how extreme it is, right? Because there's a big gray zone. And historically, you know, countries that have been at odds with each other on many fronts, including in the political arena, which is largely driven basically by posturing and signaling and so on, and sometimes by action, have been doing trade together for centuries. You know, they've been spying and selling, and investing is no different. You're basically selling financial services, and then you're, you know, onwardly selling that money as an investor for a piece of the company of your investee companies. So it's the same thing. Like, it's just trade, and people will have to draw the line. And I'm sure that there'll be, even in like unsavory regimes, there'll be like buckets of like, you know, do not touch under any circumstances bucket. You can imagine who you might want to put in there. And then there'll be another bucket, which is like a bit of a gray area.
Absolutely. Anything else that you guys want to move on?
Yeah, let's move on.
Yeah, no, good, okay. good article. I'm glad that this conversation is happening. I'd be curious to hear from anyone at Sifted, like how much traction this article is getting, if any VCs are watching this and have read this and it has informed any aspect of how they operate, would love to hear that, although it's not the kind of thing VCs would probably talk about publicly. We might reach a point one day where people are actually talking about this. For a long time, like diversity, for example, was a topic which was a taboo, in the sense that like everyone in venture capital knows that women and underrepresented founders are like, you know, poorly represented in investments. And some funds are now starting to talk about it. Just like we talked the other day, funds are talking about like, you know, work-life balance or toxic cultures or what have you. And then there are some that will just say, no, like, you know, this is not us, or it doesn't apply to us, or, you know, they'll just kind of ignore it.
Awesome. So I want to talk about Alzheimer's disease as a trillion-dollar opportunity. And just to give some background, it's one of the big four killers. 8% of healthcare spend in the US, $300 billion a year, is going to Alzheimer's and the associated costs. By 2050, they think it's going to reach $1 trillion. At the moment, on a global stage, $1 trillion a year is going into Alzheimer's, and it's going to triple over the next decade. So it's a huge unmet need. And over the past two decades, we've kind of had this death valley of Alzheimer's research where we've had no new treatments coming out. And the ones we already have are basically not great. And I say all of this, I don't want to kind of make light of the impact on the person and patient and families of Alzheimer's, but let's just talk about the business opportunity. But recently, three new drugs have come out in the Alzheimer's space. And these drugs are all monoclonal antibodies, which basically means they use a cool new technology and they're really expensive. The most recent one is called donanemab. And I'll give the bull case for this drug. And then Imran, if you want to jump in.
Can you say the name again?
It's donanemab.
How many? You, the first time you said it, there were five syllables. The second time you said it, there were four. Which one is it?
I think it's donanemab. I think
it's correct. That's it. I think you're right.
If I say it slowly,
the first one was donanemab.
I don't know whether to say it slowly and correctly or just sort of stutter it quickly. But anyway, so Eli Lilly just last week in a May 3rd press release announced results of their phase 3 trial, which shows that this new drug, this new expensive, cool new technology drug, slows the rate of cognitive decline in Alzheimer's by 35%. And they also tested some real world outcomes. So this, the cognitive decline stuff is just a kind of cognitive test they do, but it also by 40% lessens the decline in abilities to do things like driving, managing their finances, and holding conversations. So in my mind, what an amazing new drug. Is this going to change the game for Alzheimer's? And is this going to be the next blockbuster? Hey guys, what follows is a discussion on Eli Lilly's recent press release on their new Alzheimer's drug. This paper has not been peer reviewed yet, and none of this constitutes clinical advice. If you have any concerns about your or a loved one's treatment of Alzheimer's, it's best to speak to a doctor. Right, let's get back to it.
My view, so first of all, this is an interesting result. There is evidence now to show that the disease course has been affected. But I think there's a whole bunch of stuff to disentangle here around how science is communicated, how results are communicated, not just for the public, but also for people who are living with this condition, who will see the results of these papers, the press releases, the headlines, and will sort of index on the reaction of people in the community, scientific community, or the patient community who really want to celebrate and, you know, blow wind in the sails of like any progress. But I actually think this still leaves a lot to be desired in terms of the actual results. When you look at the results here, and like this is a press release, this is not a scientific paper, so all of the data has not been released. But there has been some interesting discussion online of people inferring the actual underlying data from what has been said. And basically, the difference between the decline on one of the scores, an 18-point scale of cognitive decline, is about 0.7 on the 18-point scale between the placebo and between the actual drug. So, you know, that's a really small delta in the decline. And most patients will not notice a reduction in decline of that magnitude. So the clinical significance of the result is questionable, even though the statistical significance is strong, which basically means that although the effect is small and not going to change that dramatically the quality of life of patients, you know, they will still experience cognitive decline over time. It might just be slowed ever so slightly. The statistical significance means that the result that we're seeing is unlikely due to be like a random spurious result. It is, you know, we have to assume it's more likely, very likely, in fact, that this is because of the drug.
So we're measuring the cognitive decline in Alzheimer's disease on an 18-point test. It's almost like a cognitive test. And we find that when you take this really expensive, cool new drug, and versus when you do nothing, that the difference between your results on that test is 0.7 out of 18. So
yeah, which is less than 5%. Yeah, it's basically like 4% delta in your cognitive decline over a period of about a year, I think it was.
And they've kind of, in their press release, dressed up this difference using relative percentages to make it sound massive, when actually, yeah, in absolute terms, it's actually just, again, just a very small difference.
Yeah, yeah, because yeah, the headline, I mean, if you look at the press release, the headline is like, 47% of patients showed no clinical progression compared to 29%, and 35 to 40% less decline in your cognitive function. The reason that those numbers sound big, even though we've just discussed this like tiny absolute change, is because their relative declines in the treatment and the control arm, meaning that because you've got a very small decline, because Alzheimer's is a slowly progressive disease, you've got a relatively small decline in a one-year period. I'm not saying it's not important, but it's relatively small. So a small change, clinically small change in that small decline, actually is relatively like 30 to 40% reduction in decline. So I think if you just read the headline data and you think that, you know, this has eliminated, say, half of Alzheimer's disease burden because it's like 40%, 50% or something like that, then that would be a misinterpretation of the data. Adam, do you want to say a little bit more about the results themselves?
Yeah, so a few issues here. First of all, I think there's a bit of picking and choosing here with the results from Lilly. Uh-huh. So the primary endpoint was met, but they didn't really report much on that. They focused more on the one of the secondary outcomes.
Adam, can you explain what's this whole this primary and secondary endpoint business, and why is this something?
Well, so
that
if you have a drug and you want to measure its effectiveness, how do you measure the effectiveness? You define, before you start the study, you define the things that you're looking at. And then you define it, you have a primary endpoint, which is the primary thing you're measuring, and then you have a whole bunch of secondary ones. But what usually happens is you kind of have a long list of secondary endpoints, and Imran, maybe you can chime in here.
The problem is that, you know, when you're doing an experiment, you need to declare, it's considered like better scientific practice to declare upfront what you're actually trying to measure and what result you're gunning for. So you have a hypothesis. That's the kind of cornerstone of science, is a kind of falsifiable hypothesis. So you have a primary endpoint, which is, I'm going to run this experiment and I'm looking for a change in X measure, and I think it's going to change from, you know, X to Y. And that's how clinical trials are sized in terms of the number of participants based on your estimation of the treatment effect, and other things like how many patients might drop out of the study because of side effects or other complexity. So if you see a study that is like minimizing the importance of the primary endpoint or really elevating the importance of the secondary endpoint, that's a little bit of a sign that people are basically like fishing for significant results. That means that they run the study, they gather all the data, and then in a kind of retrospective manner, they're kind of like pattern matching or fitting, like where does the data support a certain hypothesis rather than being hypothesis driven a priori. And that's much more likely to be basically gamed, because a lot of the results from research studies, and when you see confidence intervals on a result, those are probabilistic like measures of the likelihood that that result would have been produced by chance. So if you are measuring like 20 different secondary endpoints or 30 different secondary endpoints, let's say if you're measuring 20, the accepted standard on the threshold of confidence that this is a real result, not a chance result, is what you call a p-value of 0.05, which means that there's a 5% chance that the result you're seeing is due to just totally random chance in biology in the environment. So you run an experiment, you find a result, it looks like there's something real there, but it's a 5% chance that that result is not real. So if you have 20 secondary endpoints, you know, you could find one in 20, which is 5%, that shows like some significant, statistically significant result. So it's really important to pay attention to this. And in this study is actually not too bad. I actually think that's not the principal issue with this study.
And the other problem is, of course, that these monoclonal antibodies, which this drug belongs to, are really expensive. I mean, we're talking, I don't know if they've priced this yet, but it's likely to be something like $30,000 to $60,000 a year for treatment. So for something that's really what looks like inconsequential or insignificant, or it's not going to be a needle mover in the course of your disease, that's a lot of money like to be spending on this, right?
Absolutely. And I think that it shouldn't really be put into clinical practice yet, based on these studies.
Why would you not? Why would you? So is it just on price you're saying that, Adam? Like, let's say you're a patient with this condition, or a family member had it.
Yeah, just on price. Yeah, okay. I think based on price.
Yeah, so on the health economic stuff, it looks like the analysis they've done, and again, I don't think they have the full pricing for this, but it seems like it would cost in the range of about $200,000 per quality adjusted life year. So that's basically you'd have to spend $200,000 to get an extra year of good quality life, right? That's roughly what that means, which is a lot.
The price point that we kind of benchmark against is usually what, around 20 to 50 in the UK?
Yeah. So this is way over. So I wonder, because I think the other example in 2021, we had aducanumab, which was a very controversial. This was the first new Alzheimer's drug in 18 or 20 years. And that was very, very controversial, because when they did the cost effectiveness for that, it looked like it would cost something like $1 million per quality adjusted life year added onto someone's life. And that has not been approved by Medicaid or Medicare, or indeed in the UK either. So I wonder if this is great, and I don't mean to disparage what these great researchers and pharmaceutical companies are doing, but will this be available to people on insurance or on their national health services? Looks unlikely.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that. I think unless there's like a specific deal struck that brings the quality and incremental cost effectiveness of this drug over other types of care down substantially, I would say by orders of magnitude, then I think this is going to struggle in many nations to get widespread approval, simply because of the scale of the problem and the way that a drug like this can blow up your health budget. But I think there's another issue here. So we've talked about the small absolute change. Yeah, absolutely. We talked about the small absolute change, which sounds big in relative terms, and is statistically significant, but clinically not so significant. The other issue is safety, right? And there is a principle in medicine, which is, you know, first do no harm, primum non nocere, I think it is in Latin. I'm not a classicist, but something like that. First do no harm, right? So this drug has a significant rate of like quite scary sounding side effects, okay? So one in four patients developed something called ARIA-E. So ARIA-E stands for amyloid-related imaging abnormalities, right? So these are artifacts you can see on a brain scan from somebody who's taking medications in this category, where you see edema, which is basically swelling and water collecting in the brain because there's something happening in there, typically inflammation. You can also see bleeding, right? So one in four patients taking the actual drug developed brain swelling, and 3 in 10 taking the drug experienced some kind of hemorrhage inside the brain. And it says here that 3 out of the 900 or so patients in the trial who were on the actual drug died. 2 deaths were linked directly to a drug side effect, which is this ARIA side effect. And the other one occurred after a severe case of ARIA. So if in a 3 in 1,000 people are basically dying of a side effect, that's a 0.3% mortality rate on the drug. And if you scale that up to 1 million patients in the UK, that's something like 3,500 patients in the 12-month period being given the drug who are going to die
for a very marginal benefit, right?
For a very marginal benefit, yeah. I mean, I know it's low. It's like 1 in 300 for participants, and there are many other things that we do as patients that we have to subject ourselves to with worse side effect profiles, but it's not trivial, you know, and this is the brain. It's not like, you know, local injection site reaction or something. This is actual brain swelling and hemorrhage.
So I think the headline here is very interesting, not ready for prime time, but there is maybe a bit of a question mark. Is this approach actually the right approach to dementia? Is accumulation of beta amyloid the actual driver of symptoms? I think there's a big question mark here.
Say more about that. I've heard about this being like a contentious issue.
It is a bit of an issue where experts in the area disagree on the primary cause. And is this accumulation of this protein that is targeted by these drugs, is it the actual driver of the disease, or is it just a byproduct or kind of an insignificant byproduct of the pathology, the disease process here?
Why does that matter?
I think because we're targeting this protein and expecting results based on it, but it might not work because with the understanding of the pathology is flawed here.
Let me ask you guys a question in terms of the digital health startup opportunity in Alzheimer's. So again, multi-trillion dollar market. What are the opportunities for startups? I spoke to Nikhil from Craniometrics, who went to YC. He's this crazy impressive guy. He's like 23 and just has accomplished so much. But Craniometrics is looking to be the all-in-one care platform for Alzheimer's, end-to-end. So you get the early detection, that's beneficial as well, because a lot of these drugs that pharma are making, you need to spot people who are in early Alzheimer's or in early decline and then treat them. So that's useful from a pharma perspective as well. Then all the therapeutic management, then all the care needs that go into it. So if you own this whole platform, that looks like a huge opportunity. I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on big startup opportunities of what they could be doing.
Yeah, I think there's two elements here. There's kind of interventions, but there's also tracking, as you said. So early detection, but there's also something before that, which is...
You're not allowed to mention your startup, Adam.
Yeah, no, which is accurately or kind of giving a person their risk of dementia based on genetic data and also based on different biomarkers. So I think there is an opportunity here because no one has actually nailed the tracking of dementia in an easy way. We still use these composite scores.
Wait, Adam, is that something you do in your longevity practice? Is that, do people ask you, can you tell me how likely I am to get Alzheimer's? Because it almost seems like one of those things, like what's the point of knowing? There's not much you can do about it. Like, I don't really want to know. Is that something that you offer or people ask for?
Yeah, we do. And we do genetic testing kind of based on family history. We're not a bit super precise, so we would say you're at like an increased risk or a low risk. There are some things that you can do, but they're mostly related to kind of general health stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, improving your metabolism in general can improve your risk of dementia.
Yeah, Adam, I've got a feeling that we've talked about the amyloid hypothesis and how that might be barking up the wrong tree. I think you'll agree with me as well. This is all going to come back to metabolic syndrome or some kind of inflammatory process going on in the body that's contributing.
Well, it's all going to come back to the drivers of aging. Like it's an aging process in the brain. And I think it's going to be, it's caused by, like, I'm not an expert in this area, but it's caused by probably a quasi-programmed genetic process where the side effects of it is accumulation of cellular damage represented by this protein, but I don't think that's the actual primary cause. It's a quasi-programmed genetic process in the cells of the brain.
And the only treatment will be Adam's new startup, Numenor.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, 5% off for the next 24 hours only if you book with a special code. It's also interesting to think, like, what happens to society when everybody's living longer and the cognitive decline that usually kind of causes sort of a planned obsolescence of the workforce at some point in life, where most people would just stop working. It's even in like knowledge workers who are using their brains more than anything. As they get older, like they're not losing their ability to work, and they're also living longer and they're needing sustenance for longer as they age. So I think there's like a interesting thing. You know, we saw the kind of very strong reactions in France to a relatively small change in the age at which you can claim your pension, as I understand it. Which actually is bringing France in line with many other countries, but it kind of caused like national riots and things like that. So there's going to come a point where, you know, I think people can work longer and they may have to work longer. I don't know, some of them may want to work longer, but many people may not want to do that. But the kind of biology that underpins those decisions being made at some point in history has actually fundamentally changed.
Absolutely.
Guys, I'm still having problems with my battery, so I'm going to die in a bit.
Yeah, let's wrap up.
Longevity doctor is going to run out of juice.
All right, let's wrap up with some audience feedback there. That was interesting. I think that was good. So we got a few nice comments. One from Sridhar already saying, "This is great. I was actively looking for the AI and medicine intersection. Keep up the good work." And then we got another comment from an Arabic fan who I can only presume is one of Adam's sort of stans, saying, "Keep going. It was amazing and excited with three love hearts." I don't know whether it was one for each of us or all three were for Adam, but that was nice to receive as well. So yeah, got some nice feedback.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Next time I want to discuss this Wall Street Journal article about rapamycin.
Really?
Yeah, there's a new article out. I'll share it.